thinking about university and entering it with hope and expectation, but disillusionment sets in. It's called Fledglings. We sauntered into Latin quarters. Fledglings donning cap and gown. Mediocrity seeped from our eyes. Tiptoeing uncertainty across shadows of the Sorbonne, where bicycles wore college smiles and brevity eluded our adolescent flesh. Opportunity lay before us in degrees, as expectation, embellished with stiff upper lip, transcended to find a space where nothing really mattered. Broken words, bound in silence, slipped from our grasp as we sat and watched the fading ink.
Thanks, Linda. And now we have John McNally.
Okay, this is the footer poem I had. A Karma Sutra calligraphy. I dip my pen in her peak cunt, rock slowly, moist like snail, a puppet of desire. I probably should have answered that one. This is Perseus. If you remember, Perseus was the meteor shower that happened there recently. Perseus, golden tears across the stars, a perfect night by the woodman's cottage, a gothic shadow against the velvet forest, horses gallop in the darkness, a satellite and the space station almost collide, crafty beers, candles and good company. A seamless night, long walk home down the avenue. What we didn't know that night was that at the other side of the wood, after careful planning, consideration and tying up loose ends, tired of fighting the demons, he had hung himself. Perseus, golden tears streaked across the stars. If I have time, I can read you a quick bit of prose.
Yeah.
After 2 minutes, you can say stop.
Timer on now.
2 seconds now, it's time for you.
Okay. I don't just wear the pirate aesthetic. I also live the maritime life, believe it or not. Every Saturday I rode crooks along the Lee. I used to cycle down the marina until the pockmarked road rattled my bike to pieces and probably some of my joints. It's still a quick stroll down the Centre Park Road, turn right and past the Duggars to get to the boat club. It's a great way to see the city from the much sung about but much ignored Lee. However, it does depend on the tides. Last Saturday was a high tide, and given our reluctance to once again get intimate with Brian Boru and Christy Ring, we headed towards Black Rock and Loch Mahon. It was with some misfortune that I was nominated captain of my boat, misfortune because I had 5 people for a 3-person boat. Thus, not wanting to resemble, or even worse, sink like a Cuban refugee ship, my first duty was to evict one of the crew. Eventually we cast off and made good headway against the wind and the tide. A couple of unnerving passes too close to the container ships of the Tivoli, due to a wall of plastic boats and their so-called rescue boat. Hey mister, Mr. Hornby wants his boat back. We reached the mouth of the Loch Mahon, intention to round the red buoy marker. However, the wind and waves picked up, and noticing the other curricks had tied up at the castle, we made the equivalent of a handbrake turn in the curric and tied up. This was a novel experience for me, and I was delighted at the serendipity of our French member's parents visiting for the weekend. I wonder if they think we always storm the castle to pillage coffee every week. After they had finished their 8-course brunch, we decided to head back. We headed off second, though being in a racing curve and having successfully left our second passenger stranded on the slip, we soon took the lead. Not all copacetic though, there was still a novice in the boat. The sun was shining, but I was still getting thoroughly soaked. Almost back, I glanced right, and a Mondeo was booting it backwards up the marina, towards town. Okay. Then they slow down and keep pace with our boat. Okay. Then they stop, doors open, and a middle-aged guy and his probably 13-year-old daughter rush to the quayside, waving. Now I'm confused. Have I forgot to turn on my lights? Is the door open? has somebody falling out of the boat without any noticing. They shout in what might be a Scottish accent, "There's a horse in the water!" Sorry, Rob. But all I can hear is a horse version of the Australian, "There's a shark in the water!" Sorry. I have to balance up. What do I do now? There's a horse in the water. Am I hearing this? I look around. Is that my time or is it last time? I look around. Oh fuck, there is a horse in the water. What do I do now? What do I do with this information? Canvas and flailing hooves don't mix. So I ask the crew, what do we do? We're the first Kirk. We at least go over, see where the other Kirks are and show them where this horse is. So we travel over towards the horse. We see this guy running down the quay wall going, "That's my horse, get my horse." And we're thinking, there's three men in the Kirk running towards your horse. What the fuck do you think we're going to do? So the horse is wild-eyed, foaming mouth, it has that death grimace on it, and we catch up with it. And it's going down the north side of Millennium Park, and it's steep walls, and there's nothing, not even a slipway to get up on. So he's going down towards the old Liverpool boat dock, and he might get under it, and his reins might get caught up in it. And I spot these steps, and there's a couple in the car park, and I'm like, "Call the horse." And like, "What do you want me to do with the horse? Why is there a horse? Is it your horse?" And I'm going, "Stop interrogating me, just call the fucking horse." And she stops, and you can see her thinking. And the horse stops, and the oars stop. And for a moment we're looking, what's she going to come out? And she's like, "I suppose I could tempt it out with treats." I have this image of her fly fishing for a horse in the lee with a lump of sugar on the end of the line. The horse looks at me, senses my irritation, and turns around and starts swimming the right way. End of the story is we had 100 Kirks, well, that's probably an exaggeration, but a swimming pie ball coming across the river, and then a hero arrives in a steel boat and a lopsided face. They manage to get the horse, and then the guy that owns the horse strips down. So I'm like, "You're not getting in the water," and you've never seen someone put their clothes on so fast. I don't know what it was. It must have been the captaincy going to my head. Then the fire brigade arrives. Who calls the fire brigade for a horse? What are they going to do? Finish it off with their hoses? Three fire engines pull up, the jeep behind. They get out and look, "Yeah, that's definitely a horse." Eventually the horse gets pulled up, and I know for certain that when Burger King say that their fish burgers have been caught freshly in the lee, I know it's a true story. So that's a work in progress, as you can tell. So hold your horses.
And now we have Edward Dwyer.
Funeral suit. Today, you start the job that will slowly kill you, having been the successful candidate this time out of hundreds, maybe thousands, who applied. You leave the house in your best suit and practiced smile, your wife's kiss still tingling on your lips, the sunny morning embracing you, the polished, wistful melody of blackbird's song to score the skip in your step. The neighborhood's waft of bacon and eggs sees you off in your pristine Ford Focus like a wave from God, but you are dying noticeably as you pull out onto the M7, the long road to your slow death, and everywhere there are pristine vehicles driven by men like you in practiced smiles and best suits on their way to jobs that will kill them slowly. The interviewer never mentioned that the successful applicant will demonstrate a great ability to die slowly, but it was a kind of fine print in his practiced smile you failed to read before you'd signed the contract that gave your entire self slowly away. And now, as the road goes on, and the sky darkens with only the noise of honking horns, you leave behind you a long trail of dust all the way back to the sun and the music, back to the living. This one is not quite so dark, and it's called Conversation with a Daisy. This surely is not what was meant for you? Did you never see your true potential? Too beautiful to be common, growing wild out here among weeds and desolate men's hopelessness. You were meant for a gardener's garden, but then maybe so much of your beauty comes out of innate wildness, your blatant disregard for multicultural authority, such a grower I please attitude. I'll never know, but looking at you here now, poking your head up out of stones along this railway line, I wonder how we could have gone so astray, the both of us, and found each other in these most shabby of circumstances. Is this where we've always belonged, or could it have been different once? Might you have been the envy of roses and tulips once upon a time? Woven into the golden hair of a desirable woman, brief life it would have been, but perfection should be a brief thing, no drawn-out standstill. Don't you know it would have been a bright and sunny day, the day she'd have picked you? Maybe during a walk by the riverside. But she is never going to be out walking in these parts. And we're so much alike, you and I, it occurs to me now. I have my own regrets, of course. She might have been mine once, you know. A desirable woman, whoever she is, or another like her, holding my hand, a bright and sunny day, a walk by the riverside, daisy woven into her golden hair.
Sorry, I had to cut you short there, but there's a few more people on the open mic, so if you could keep it to one poem, that would be great. Okay, next up is Joe Sweeney.
This is a different take on birthday parties. I have to be able to see this, you see. Birthday parties. If you are ill, do people come to your house to celebrate? If you have a fever and your temperature rises another degree, do people cram into your bedroom and sing songs? Of course not. Yet when they hear that it's your birthday, they arrive, looking very cheerful that you are another step closer to the grave. Age is not something to be treated in this cavalier fashion. It may come in cheerful guise on your birthday, but don't be deceived. It is a smiling killer. It is death's scout. It is reminding you of an old claim. Even when you are still an infant, even as you are being half drowned at the font, age has already taken out a contract on you. It is awaiting the first installment. And every year thereafter, this godfather, this arch criminal, returns, and while you are being distracted with trivial gifts, he's stealing the greatest gift of all, your life. When you're young, birthday parties are a delight. They hang loose and light as a daisy chain around your neck. Life seems to stretch on forever. As you get older, however, the daisy chain tightens, becomes heavier, feels like a prisoner's collar. Celebrating your birthday each year feels like giving in to the kidnapper or searing wine with the burglar. As you get on in life, you may find yourself tiptoeing nervously around as your birthday approaches, hoping to go unnoticed. Maybe this year you think no one will remember. You become evasive, avoid anyone who might know it is your birthday, and you're not alone. All over the world, old and middle-aged people can often be seen ducking furtively out of sight down dark alleys and side streets. They're not criminals. They simply dread going home because they know the Reaper will be there in the shadows, scythe in one hand, birthday card in the other. They're afraid to be found in. They're afraid to be found out. They look forward to friends singing happy birthday the way turkeys look forward to carolers at the farm gate singing jingle bells. Until you establish your real inner age, you are probably better off avoiding birthday celebrations altogether. No civilized society should allow decent people to be turned on a spit every year. Their goose will be cooked soon enough without their being reminded every year. Birthday parties can so easily turn into sinister dramas. Scurrilous relatives lurk in the kitchen where they push wax steaks firmly down into the birthday cake. They do so with emphasis, as if to make the point that you, the recipient, are not immortal and must not think you can be hanging around forever like a vampire and not leaving any money to your descendants. Next, the candles are lit, the main lights are turned off, and your relatives stand at the doorway holding the cake. Their faces are eerie in the candlelight. They exchange a last conspiratorial glance, and then they come towards you, offering you a conflagration. An expectant silence falls as you are escorted to the table like a French aristocrat to the guillotine. You stretch out your neck and blow like mad in an effort to quell the inferno. You begin to feel dizzy and have your work cut out not to fall headfirst into the flames. Red-faced and breathless, and having failed to blow out most of the candles, you are forced to pinch out the remaining ones between your thumb and finger. You're so numb you can't even feel them burning. You straighten yourself with what dignity remains, and then, with the smell of singed hair in your nostrils, hair you can ill afford to lose, people burst into applause. It is the most inhuman thing you could ever be present at. Next thing, some bright spark pipes up with happy birthday, as if it was an inspired and original idea. And children, grandchildren, in-laws, outlaws, so-called friends, former colleagues, all join in with gusto. Their eyes gleam with unnatural enthusiasm, like those of a lynching mob in an old western. They may not be planning to hang you, but some of them look as if they might be distantly thinking of a wake and a will. You smile forgivingly. You don't want to be too hard on your friends and relations. It is, after all, only natural for them to expect that one day your death may help them pay off their mortgages.
Thank you very much, Jill Sweeney. Happy birthday. Next we have Donal Maloney.
This is a short story. Really, about half of it should be about 5 minutes. And it's called Ready. I always thought the only way to watch a film was with the sound blaring. And partial as it was to a Western, when I got home from work after midnight, sharing walls with other people was a problem. Turning up the volume to hear the dialogue, and then turning it down every time there's a gunfight, that ruins the whole thing. Civic-minded guy that I am, I solved the problem by moving out of town. Sometimes I watch films before work as well, and one morning I was watching Unforgiven when Mossy rapped on the window. The doorbell was working fine, but sure, why would you bother? He knocked just as Clint was about to deliver the line, "Who's the fella that owns this shithole?" Seeing it written down, it doesn't look all that great, but films are all about the atmosphere. And as soon as I saw Mossy's big watery eyes in the window, the lamp sucked up the genie and the illusion in one slurp. "Door's open," I shouted. He came in swinging a plastic bag full of cans. classic, he said, pointing at Clint's waxen face frozen on the screen. He wasn't being sincere. I knew he made fun of my love of cinema behind my back. Don't let me interrupt, he said. But I knew that if I kept watching that he'd talk regardless. And it's agony to have someone you can't stand jabbering in your ear and drowning out something you're actually interested in. I'll watch it later, I lied. For me, there are basically two kinds of film. Ones that bear interruption and ones that don't. Take Red River. You can pause that anywhere and go off to work. When you get back home, you're right back in the action. But other films have a delicate atmosphere and you have to watch them straight through. If I get interrupted during The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, for example, I'll just stop the film and watch it from the start to a different day. And Unforgiven is particularly delicate. I don't even like to go for a piss when it's off. Mossy pulled out a can of super cheap Polish lager. I'd come to hate watching him drink. He spread his thin wet lips all over the roof of the can and made intimate sucking and gulping noises. I looked at my watch, 11:30. I had no idea when he would leave. My shift in the pub started at 4. I could say I had to start earlier, but then he might follow me in and continue drinking there. The true horror of seeing Mossy was that you never knew when you'd be rid of him. Came down to see Elaine, he said. No one home there, but what can you do? You make the effort. Elaine is my sister, and she and Mossy were separated. She was probably at work, I said. Probably was, all right, he agreed. When did you get there? I asked. Let me see now, the shoes, the bus, and 9:30 I'd say it was. Then she was definitely at work, I said. She works 9 to 5. I was careful to purge my voice of sarcasm and let the facts do the mocking. She usedn't it, oh, did she? Retorted Mossy. No, I thought. She used to work 8 to 4, and that would have made you even later. But as an experienced barman, I knew when to kill a debate before it got legs. You're right, I said. Anyway, said Mossy. Then I called on a buddy in Lismore Park, but he wasn't there either, so I came out here. Sure, why not, I said. The bus don't go back till later, he added, as he lit a cigarette. Later. He took 2 massive drags and flicked a stem of ash towards the mouth of his first empty can. His aim wasn't great. Des here by any chance, asked Mossy. Des, short for Desiree, is my niece, Mossy's daughter. I shook my head. She's at school. Mossy gave me a hard look as if to ask me what right I had to know that. I suppose, I added, and shrugged my shoulders, being midweek. I stared at him and didn't let a shadow of a smirk cross my face. Mossy took a pink pencil from his pocket and handed it to me. Can you give her this and tell her Daddy loves her, he said. I nodded a lying nod. When will you see her again? I don't know, I said. There was something about the questions Mossy asked that made me lie all the time. I was minding Des on Saturday morning while Elaine got her hair cut. Sure you'll make sure she gets it anyway, he continued. You can count on it, I said. Mossy burst out laughing. You can count on it. John Wayne said that, he does. He clapped me on the shoulder and said he needed to go to the Japs. His aim wasn't great there either. When Mossy started going out with Elaine, I thought he was brilliant. Me and Elaine had been through some dark shit. Mom dying of bowel cancer, Dad hanging himself, and Mossy was full of life and chat. He spent a lot of time with me, and I was flattered. I thought it was part of his wooing of Elaine, a respect he was showing me as the only surviving male in the family. He was 10 years older than me, and looking back, there were lots of things I misunderstood about him. One Sunday, for example, I took him to play pitch and putt in Kilbarry. Despite never having played before, the fluky prick got a hole in one. He celebrated by fucking his rented pitcher into the stream and pulling his trousers and boxers down and waving his lad around. When we finished the round, he insisted I go drinking with him. In fairness to him, he bought the pints. He kept on striking up conversations with strangers and joking about ringing in sick in the morning. Compared to people dying on you, this was fun. But there were signs there, all right, and if we'd been older and less depressed, I might have been able to read them. Your flush is broken, announced Mossy on his return. He downed some beer, lit a cigarette and took out his phone. Important call, he said, and rang someone. The sleeves of his t-shirt rolled up by his shoulders, revealing his faded tattoos of breasts and daggers and fish. Although they were cheap enough to be intimidating, I never felt his arms had the bulk for them. I'll stop it there.
Thanks, Donald. Next, Cabin Holden.
Hi, guys. I'd like to do a poem that I know you've heard a lot, but I'd like to do it again. This is The Dreamsmith. He told them he planted the seeds of dreams in the furrows of the brows of their daughters' and sons' minds. Well, they said bullshit. He said all they'll need now is water and sunshine. He said, go to where dreams walk. Climb to the clouds. At the top of the beanstalk, you'll see through the shroud, so follow the rabbit right over the rainbow. Climb up the tresses that hang from the window. Make a trail out of breadcrumbs back out of the woods. Just look out for the girl in the red riding hood. Go tripping, trip-trapping, right over that bridge. Throw the troll in the river if he challenges this. Sing all the dragons to sleep in their vaults. And never look back, for you might turn to salt. Never look down, for you walk on the sky. Throw this over your shoulder when danger is nigh. Don't ask for the password, give this in reply. Click both heels together and say it three times. Slippers of ruby, slippers of glass. Look for the beauty that none could surpass. Ask of the mirrors that hang from the walls, and look for the garden where night never falls. Treasure the feather that fell from the firebird's tail. Send your last arrow to the gap in the scales. No knife skins the lion except its own claws. So the puck of your hurl, send it down the hound's jaws. Now the forest calls and answers, and Pan pipes an eerie tune, where they dine on monkey mutton and build blowguns from bamboo, where it's deep and dark and wet and hot, and odd and fearful strange. There's no guessing what was in the pot, and now your vision starts to change. But you've come to meet the serpent, who bites behind between the eyes. There's no reason to be fearful for it, she seeks to make you wise. So wash your day wounds in the rivers, the settings of the sun. Seek the answers to the riddles in the blister on your thumb. With whirls and loops and nation's hoops and cries of hoka hay, black elk rides with the buffalo and the people come to pray. So sing with the bullfrog, howl with the wolf god, the hoof and paw and wing. For the tide will breathe Persephone when winter falls to spring. When dressed as a crow, the Morrigan comes. The cries will be deadened with bangings of drums. The snow will be reddened, but no, it will melt. For when the sun joins the battle, there is warmth to be felt. So pull on your armor and follow the grail. Tie yourself to a stone if your strength starts to fail. Pull the ropes tight if you die standing up. Drink from the chalice and drink from the cup. But don't let the water slip through your hands. For there's looms, weights and scissors, and a trickle of sand. And the fates will eye the hero's thread with a blessing and a curse. For Judas paid the ferryman from the silver in his purse. When you've wandered in the desert, the devil for the sea, you come across the ocean, craft a raft from twine and trees, and let the currents take your coracle to the shores of blessed isles. For you go to meet the oracle who knows you for your trials. For that sea grew in her garden, its open outer flower, whose petals four each carry quarter of the goddess and her power. The further plains are yellow earth, as the petal of the east. The scarlet mouth of the sacred south brings healing to the feast. From holy water westernmost, the blue of rain appears. One petal white moves to the north, to cleanse us of our fears. And now we're compassed in that blossom. We are heavy on our stem, atop the root that brought us forth to take us back again. So kiss the girl who kissed the frog. Climb holy mountains clothed in fog, where youth's old fountain flows to sea. I'll follow you, you follow me. The odds are with us, the force is strong. The gods within us march us on. We are stories that we tell ourselves. The planets gather round. We are that tide, its rise and swells, the silence and the sound. He told them they planted the seeds of dreams in the furrows of the brows of their daughters and sons' minds. And when they said bullshit, he said, "Oh, they'll be now. It's water and sunshine." Thank you.
Well, we may have heard it again, but I think if you come next week and you say it again, if you come the week after and say it again and the week after that, we'd still be happy. So, thank you.
And next up is another fine man for the slam, Fergus Costello.
I was in the company of a distinguished Scottish man this afternoon, and he mentioned in the course of the conversation that he didn't have broadband, and reminded me of a piece of pure nonsense I stitched together a few years ago called "I Need Real Broadband." I don't have broadband. I have a stupid, useless, dongle piece of technology hanging out the side of my PC. It is slower than a three-legged donkey. I need real broadband. My son said to me, "Dad, check out Jinx Lennon on the web." He said, "Jinxie Lennon is a shining light the man can write." So I clicked onto Jinxie's site with my stupid, useless, dongle piece of shite, and I got 3 seconds, and that's all, followed by sweet feckle. Then the screen came alive again, and I got 2.5 seconds of a Jinx Lennon lyrical creation, followed by 4.5 hours of suspended animation. Then 2 seconds from the maestro in full flow, followed by 4.5 hours of Marcel Marflick, and so then 1.5 seconds of the Sultan of Sonic, followed by an eternity of cataphricantonic. Then, would you believe it, one priceless, peerless, precious second of Jinxie Lennon, alive and kicking, 3 shining syllables slipping from his jaw like diamonds falling out of his mouth, followed by forever of Jinxie Lennon, the frozen trout, mouth open, eyes closed, freeze frame. I am so ashamed I don't have real broadband. The minister said he'd roll it out, but he didn't roll it out to my house. I'm afraid I'd pass away someday and I'd have been the only person on the planet that hadn't heard James Lennon talk for more than 3 seconds at any given time, and that's a crime against art, it's a crime against culture, it's a crime against nature, it's a crime against life itself, sweet mother of divine. I need help, I need real broadband. The minister said he'd roll it out. He didn't roll it out to my house. I hope to meet James Lennon someday, I pray I do, but who will I meet? Jinxie Lennon, the word slinger I heard so much about, or Jinxie Lennon, the frozen feckin' trout, mouth open, eyes closed, freeze frame. I'm so ashamed I don't have broadband. I hear that they have better broadband over in Lithuania than we have here. I swear to God I'm not making this up. Lithuania! What the fuck is that all about? The minister said he'd roll it out. Didn't roll it out to my house. I can't believe that there are fellas and girls right now this second watching and listening to Jinx Lennon on YouTube over in Lithuania. And all I can get is 3 poxy seconds on my stupid useless dongle piece of shite. On what fucked up parallel universe could that be right? Minister said he'd roll it out. Didn't roll out to my house. The minister needs to get his paper out. The minister needs to be dragged out in the middle of the night, into the middle of a field, and thrashed within an inch of his life, preferably with my stupid, useless, dangling piece of shit. I do it myself, except I'm a pacifist. But if I ever meet that so-and-so, I'm afraid I'd do him serious damage. And that won't bring him or me any great joy, unless perhaps turns out there's broadband up in Mountjoy, but I have my doubts, because the stupid, useless, poxy horlicks of a shagging minister forgot to roll the shagging thing out. He said he'd roll it out, but he didn't roll it to my house. Can you believe it? Let her win. I swear to God, I'm not making this up. Let her freaking win!
Nice one, Fergus. And you just reminded me of Jinx Lennon. Everybody should check out Jinx Lennon. Yeah. He's awesome. Okay, and next up we have Charles Clark.
Had a number of things about media. This was part of a series, well, in a manner of speaking. It'll start movie. We got Igor, to do the script, sliver bits. Money was there for a loan. Frank was expert on banks, taxes, computers. New York was on the line twice daily. Casting was Tweedale. He wanted Redford, with Street to play a simple village maiden. Did we shoot any of it? Some corny background stuff, Arab courtyards, spears at Aspen. It was an epic, after all. Aspen we enjoyed. Frank gave us all an opera hat, a kind of lever. Good socialist hat, he said obscurely. We wore it to the restaurant. We had complete faith in the project.
Thanks, Charles. And now we have a first timer, Wagner.
Hi. I read an attempt of translation item for a poem written by a Brazilian writer who is best known as a radio presenter. It's like a Christmas poem, but after I read it for the first time, I actually saw like a performance, like an actor performing it on TV, and it made me think that every day is like Christmas in Brazil. Mary, Joseph, Jesus. The street corner was full. It was Christmas Eve. A tattered woman begged. Hand reached out. Her name was Mary. Next to her, a man slept, oblivious to the ruthless noise of the world. His name was Joseph. Shrieks heard. Thief! A kid runs with a watch in his hands. A sudden breaking. A dead boy. His name was Jesus. The woman stared at the sad manger. There were no cows, only rats. There were no stars, only the police spinning lights. There were no kings, only men oblivious to everything.